businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programs are made possible by the Spice Box in Bevere Hall, offering fine dining on Wednesday and Friday nights. Reservations are required. The Spice Box is managed by students in the Hospitality Management Program. More information is available at 333-6520.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Well, I expect that probably you have heard or read stories like this. Two-thirds of Americans between 18 and 24 can't find Iraq on a map. Only about half of adults read a single book in the course of a year. Adults are now watching something like 7 hours of television a day. Children under six spend 2 hours a day watching TV or videos, but are read to by their parents for only 40 minutes. And one can come up with many, many examples like this. You can also argue that perhaps in America we have always had something of an anti-intellectual streak. But our guest for this morning, Susan Jacoby, says she thinks perhaps things are worse in this respect than they have ever been. In fact, she says that we are living through a crisis of knowledge involving everything about the way we learn and think. This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about some of the ideas that you will find in her recent book, The Age of American Unreason. It's published by Pantheon. It's out now in the bookstore or library, so if you're interested, you can seek it out. Let me tell you a little bit more about her. She's an independent scholar who now focuses on American intellectual history. She began her writing career as a reporter for the Washington Post. Among her many books, one entitled Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism. That book was published in 2004. Her articles and essays have also appeared in a number of other publications, just to name a few. New York Times Magazine, Washington Post Book World, LA Times Book Review, Newsday, Harper's, The Nation, Vogue. She's also program director of the Center for Inquiry in New York City. That's a rationalist think tank. And she's also a regular panelist for On Faith, a website sponsored by The Washington Post and Newsweek. She also has her own political blog, The Secularist Corner. That's on the website of The Washington Post. And she's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions from listeners are welcome. The only thing we ask is that people try to be brief in their comments and do that so that we could keep moving along, get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, questions from listeners are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana or on the Internet, and you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. Again, here locally, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Ms. Jacoby, hello.
Yes, hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Glad to talk to you. Anything in Champaign. My mother went to the University of Illinois.
So you have a legacy connection.
Well, I have a legacy connection with Champaign-Urbana.
Well, I'm pleased that you could talk with us again. And maybe I guess I should mention, too, that we did talk about free thinkers. And
I remember that
if people would like to hear that interview, they can go to our web archive and they can hear that. One of the stories that I read, and this was in one of the stories about you in the book, and that I want to ask you to tell, and it's one of those things where you just shake your head and think, this can't possibly be true. This is the story about and it was something that started you thinking about this whole issue, a story about a conversation that you overheard on September 11th, 2001. I'm sure you know the event that I'm talking about.
Yes, and the reason I didn't put this in the book is it sounds made up.
Yes.
When I was writing the book, I thought, that sounds like you made it up. But I did tell it to a reporter recently. On 9/11, I was working in the New York Public Library on Freethinkers, and like everybody else in New York, I had to walk home because the subways weren't running after the terrorist attacks. About halfway to my home, I stopped in a bar, as I suspect many New Yorkers did that day, felt they were in need of a drink. And there were two, you know, sort of 30-ish men in business suits next to me, and one of them said to the other, "This must be what Pearl Harbor felt like." And I thought, well, yeah, it must be. And the other one said to him, "What's Pearl Harbor?" Okay, but there's a third kicker ending. The first man said to him, "Oh, Pearl Harbor is a harbor the Vietnamese attacked, and it started the Vietnam War." And I thought, whoa. I didn't think at the moment, I've got to write a book about this, but it's one of those things that if you're a writer that sticks in your head and starts things percolating, I thought there's something wrong when two men, obviously, with expensive briefcases and in business suits, this is all they know about the last 60 years of American history.
And I understand your reluctance to put them in because, as you say, that when you hear that story, you think, that just could not possibly have happened. It can't be true. And in the book, you explain that it's a complicated problem. And if you're looking for explanations or looking for people to blame, it's not, you have a variety of places to place blame. But I suppose when you hear a story like that, you have to think that this is a stinging indictment of the American educational system. If people don't know what Pearl Harbor is, what hope is there?
I don't know, but the thing is obviously you don't judge people on the basis of one conversation you've overheard. But my book is full of these studies, some of which you cited, about our general ignorance about geography, about our own history. Most Americans don't know, for example, that there are 9 justices in the Supreme Court. So how can you then understand the significance of recent appointments to the Supreme Court if you don't understand that you're going to get a lot of 5-4 decisions with a new judge? In other words, if you don't know the number of justices, how can you discuss what a change in one appointment to the Supreme Court can make? We don't speak foreign languages, but I think what is worse, and what makes this worse than other eras, I'm not talking about how there was a golden age when people knew everything, but one of the most disturbing things to me is not just lack of knowledge, but contempt for knowledge and rationality. In that same poll about how little Americans know about geography, the majority of young Americans from 18 to 25 said they don't think it's important to know the locations of countries in which important news is being made. Now, not knowing the location of a country is one thing, and saying it's not important enough to know is another thing. That is a bigger failure and a whole level of contempt for the things we need to know to make, among other things, sound public decisions.
Mm-hmm. I know also in part you were, I think, inspired to write this book by another book. This was a book that was published in the early 60s by a very famous American historian, Richard Hofstadter. This book, Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, you got the Pulitzer Prize for writing this
book. Which is selling again like crazy on Amazon, by the way, and justly so.
And so this book was published in 1963, and the kind of concerns that you voice, I'm certain people have been raising those concerns for a long time. I'm sure we could go back into antiquity and find a Roman writer, a Greek writer, probably writing the same sorts of things. So having said all that, though, do you think that the place that we are today and the trend over the last couple of decades is somehow more acute, we should be more worried than we have in the past?
Yes, sure. Richard Hofstadter was writing about some traditional sources of American anti-intellectualism that have always been with us. And in some ways, he was writing about it as a cyclical thing that goes up and down. And, for example, the democratization of education in America, a good thing, also led inevitably to a lowering of standards in the sense that in the old world, where only a small percentage of people were expected to learn to read and write, obviously certain educational standards were more rigorous. So some of the sources of American anti-intellectualism are actually the flip side of some good things about the American experience. But I think a number of things have changed. The most important thing is that Richard Hofstadter was writing at what was still the dawn of the television era. He was writing while the print culture still reigned supreme over the video culture. In 1963, I don't think anyone could have imagined the reality in which we live now, in which all of us can have our portable video and digital entertainment with us 24 hours a day. And if you ride a plane or take a train, you realize how true this is, that that huge numbers of people aren't reading. They're just plugged into what's ever in their ears, or they're looking at DVDs on their portable computers. So for the first time in the history of the world, we are able to take our sort of passive forms of video entertainment with us. And that has had a lot to do with displacing reading, which I think really has made a problem, not just of anti-intellectualism, but I called my book The Age of American Unreason for a reason. Hofstadter made the correct point that anti-rationalism and anti-intellectualism aren't the same thing. There are plenty of anti-rational intellectuals then and now. But anti-rationalism also involves a contempt for evidence. It's this aggressive kind of thing that says, why do I know, a Sunni from a Shiite? Why is that important? You know, as George W. Bush once famously said when asked that a long time ago, aren't they all Muslims? This is a kind of, what does it matter if the facts are? Why do we need to know these things?
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Susan Jacoby. Her new book is The Age of American Unreasons, published by Pantheon, out now. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller, and rather than keep them waiting, we'll bring them right in. Someone who is listening in Champaign and on our line 1. Hello.
Yes.
Good morning.
Yes.
I just wanted to say, first off, that I saw the guest on... Now with Bill Moyers, and I have your book on order from Amazon, as a matter of fact.
Yes, I'm happy to hear that.
Uh-huh. And I, too, I'm but a wee lad of 54, and I, too, have a similar Pearl Harbor story that I won't go into detail, but just 20 years ago or so, I was having dinner with a very nice young woman who was in the process of getting her master's degree in education, and in the course of the conversation, I related a story about someone I knew that whose lunacy was attributed to the fact that she had lost her intended on the Arizona at Pearl Harbor, and this young woman gave me a blank look at Pearl Harbor. And I said, yeah, the beginning of the Second World War. Second World War, she didn't have a clue what I was talking about. So, but anyway, my main question was, years ago I read a book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, by Neil Postman.
Yes, a very prescient book.
And I was wondering if you had any take upon how it's been ages since I read the book, but the gist of it was that Americanus Bubianus, as H.L. Mencken used to refer to the bulk of Americana, the American citizenry, is as dumbed down as it is now, just due to the fact that it strikes me that many of my fellow Americans are just preoccupied with getting through life with a rhythm. They have to have the constant entertainment of some sort, or they just can't function.
What's your question?
How do you think that affects, how it plays into the effects that you are describing in your book and so forth? And thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death also was written before the era of personal computers. So he didn't. It was a very prescient book, and he didn't have the advantage of knowing that we would now have the 24/7 opportunity to watch people throw up on YouTube or moon us on YouTube, that kind of thing. I think how it plays into the general problem of ignorance and lack of knowledge is just simply this. Time is finite. What you are doing, if you are devoting X number of days to video, whether it's digital video or video on TV or DVDs, you only have X number of hours left to devote to anything else. And what has happened is this availability of entertainment or infotainment is so overwhelming that it crowds out a lot of other things, not just reading, by the way, but conversation, which is another staple of intellectual life and of a healthy civic culture. And don't tell me, I write for a number of blogs. The kind of thing that goes on blogs is basically not a conversation. What most blogs, there are exceptions, enable people to do is spew forth their own thoughts, however ungrammatically, in whatever unedited way, and more important, anonymously. And often, there are exceptions. The On Faith blog is quite good. There are exceptions, but mostly it's not people talking to each other and exchanging ideas so much as sort of each singing their own song into a vacuum. That's not conversation, and more important, in anonymity, there's no one to check your facts or the accuracy of what you're saying. It's one of the great appeals of the Internet. Now, I have been accused unfairly, I believe, of being just reflexively anti-technology. That's not true. All I'm saying is we need to think of technology for what it is, as a tool. I think too many Americans, and in this respect, America has always been particularly in love with technology, think of all of the things that we do on the web as some sort of a godlike new way of knowing. And all it is it's a tool. Of course, tools can transform our lives. The telephone transformed life in many respects. But once you start thinking of something as an entity in itself rather than as a tool, then it's controlling you rather than you're controlling it. For example, some critics of my book have said that I don't take any account of the explosion of reading on the Internet. That's right, I don't, because I don't think that what I do or what most people do on the Internet is reading as it's traditionally been thought. When I'm on the Internet, I'm swooping down like a vulture for bits of information. That's great. It's wonderful. But basically, the digital sources of information are basically a shortcut. And they actually encourage that sort of isolated search for bits of information without a broader context of knowledge. So I don't think that the Internet is making us smarter, as I hear people say ad nauseum. I think it's just something that we're thinking of in the wrong way. It's a tool, a great tool, but it's not something that's, quote, making us smarter just because we can find out a date or a fact, or maybe it's a wrong date or fact faster.
Let me ask you this. I'm just curious about how you would react to this idea that I think maybe if we went out and started to engage people and ask them, and we asked them a question something like this, who would you rather be? Would you rather be the smartest kid in the class, or would you rather be somewhere around the middle of the pack, maybe slightly above average, but yet somewhere around the middle? And I suspect that there are a lot of people who would say, no, I really don't want to be the smartest kid in the class because we really don't like the smartest kid in the class. Do you think that there is in Americans some sort of desire to be average?
Well, I think there's always been a kind of idea of well-roundedness that's been part of American culture. And one of the ideas, it was a word that was used a lot when I was in high school in the early 1960s. Well-roundedness mm-hmm. was very important. That's why they made girls take home Eck, because it was supposed to make you well-rounded. You learned how to make Jell-O with pears suspended and so on. But I think the idea that too much learning is a dangerous thing is quite common in America. There's a very funny thing I found in one of the historical chapters in my book. A guy from Princeton, a minister, went out to Indiana to found the university, what became Indiana University at Bloomington. And he heard the farmers riding by his house, and they were very suspicious of him. He was too educated. And one of the farmers said, I like a man that can just read. You know, in other words, meaning not too much. You know, in other words, a certain kind of democratic learning was a good thing, but not too much learning. This actually, I think, it's one of the things that's made America more susceptible to this infotainment culture, which obviously embraces the world. There are no national boundaries in it. But there are other countries, such as France and Japan, in which great learning is highly respected. So I think that our kind of tradition of sort of respecting the averageness, or not necessarily the lowest common denominator, but that it's possible to know too much for your own good, that's something that's not part of a lot of the culture of other developed countries, and I think it makes us very susceptible to kind of the worst junk that comes over the infotainment transom.
Let's talk with someone else here in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about the reading habits of Americans? I've heard it could be pretty low. I think Steve Jobs mentioned that maybe 40% of Americans read one book or less a year.
Well, actually, it's closer to 50% now. And it is that 44%, nearly half of Americans under 44 read no book at all in the course of a year. That is neither nonfiction nor fiction, neither a bodice ripper nor a self-help book. No book at all. So there's that. And we also know that newspapers are being read less and less, and even less by the young. And by the way, online editions of newspapers don't have a much larger percentage of young readers. What's been found about online newspapers is people read a lot less on them than readers of print editions. In other words, it's part of the online reading culture is, again, you swoop in like a vulture to get whatever it is that you're interested in, but you tend not to read the whole paper as was the custom in my home and many homes when I was growing up in the 1950s. I think one of the things that this does, one of the reasons in terms of civic culture and knowledge that reading is superior to getting your news in flashing glimpses from video, whether it's video on the internet or video on TV, is this. When you read things, you can compare them to other things. It's there for you to take a second look at, and people do. It's very hard. You know, for instance, you look at, you sometimes see a story about, you know, something, and you think that can't be true. And you look at it again and you compare it to something else. But what happens, you know, when you see a flash of news on TV or a flash on your start screen on AOL is this, that you don't have time almost to absorb it. So what you have is more an impression, not whatever was actually being said. And that impression, it may flit through your brain, but you don't have, because it's not written down, you don't have it to compare to something else. And that is why video, in terms of civic culture, is a very inferior way of getting information. If you look at the headlines, for example, on any of your start screens, you see that there's barely time to click on them before they change. That's deliberate. You know, in other words, certain assumptions are being made about the short attention span of people, which encourages an even shorter attention span.
What do you think about audiobooks?
Well, first of all, a lot of people use audiobooks for a lot of different reasons. Some people use audiobooks because they can't see, but I think probably what you're talking about is people who listen to audiobooks, you know, while they're driving and so on.
Yeah, or working.
You're listening to an audiobook while you're working on something else, here's the thing: you're not taking in the audiobook any more than, as I found when I turned off my, I did TV turn off week, and I found, like everybody, like many people, I would tell myself I don't watch much TV. And why I would tell myself that is because I was always reading a book while I was watching TV. But I found when I turned the TV off for a bit that I'd been losing a lot from the books because I was watching TV and reading books at the same time. If somebody is listening to an audio book and working on something else at the same time, they're not really concentrating on the audio book. It may be more possible to drive and listen to an audio book, although all of the evidence we have about multitasking is that whenever you're doing two things at once, you're not getting the same full experience as you are when you're concentrating on one thing. So this is why they're passing laws against using cell phones while driving, because people who are using their cell phones, even if they're hands-off cell phones, are not able to concentrate on their driving in the same way.
We are at our midpoint already here, and I have other callers. I would like to, though, quickly introduce again the guest for anyone who's just tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. Our guest is Susan Jacoby. She's an independent scholar. She's now focusing her work on American intellectual history. She began her career as a reporter for The Washington Post. She was on the education beat. She has contributed articles and essays to number of publications, New York Times Magazine, Washington Post Book World, LA Times Book Review, Newsday, Harper's, The Nation, Vogue. She's program director of the Center for Inquiry New York City. It's a rationalist think tank there. She's also a regular panelist for On Faith, a website that's sponsored by the Washington Post and Newsweek. Her most recent book is The Age of American Unreason. It's published by Pantheon and has just come out. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk next with the caller in Champaign and line 2. Hello.
I've heard accounts on the radio of a book that I believe is called The Alphabet and the Goddess by somebody named Schlein.
I'm sorry, I can't catch that. The Alphabet and the
Goddess?
I'm not familiar with it.
Okay, I guess that finishes this call then.
I'm sorry.
His name is Schlein.
I'm sorry. I'm just not familiar with it.
Okay.
Okay. Well, do you? I mean, do you want to try to explain the idea of the book, or something that you would like the guest to react to?
Well, as I recall, the thesis of the book was something like that the introduction of literacy to civilization led to all sorts of terrible problems, and that the reintroduction through video of much more image-oriented stuff, he thought was going to make things better. That may be wrong. No. I'm working on memory, but...
All right. Since I haven't read the book, I can't comment on it. But if that's the thesis, it's the alphabet led to terrible things. For heaven's sakes, how ridiculous! We should all be reading hieroglyphics. The reason the alphabet was originally introduced by Egyptians was when they conquered territories, it was very difficult to read hieroglyphics. And in order for people to communicate with each other, there had to be an alphabet that led to a language so that people could understand each other's language. If the thesis is that he'd like to go back to hieroglyphics, it's wrong. But maybe it's not, so I shouldn't be commenting on it.
Okay. Well, for possible future reference, I'm pretty sure his name is S-C-H-L-A-I-N, and he's written other books that are well-regarded, so it might be worth looking into.
Okay.
All right. Well, very good. We will then continue our conversation here, and we'll go next to another caller, and this would be someone in Urbana and line number 3. Hello.
Good morning, Susan.
Good morning.
I have a question and a comment. The comment first is, first of all, there are many different types of learning. Some people tend to be visual. Some people tend to be audio. Some people even tend to learn through tactile. And I'm not quite sure in this day and age that books are as relevant as they used to be, say, 30 years ago. And as far as the Internet goes, I would say it's probably the most important invention probably since Gutenberg. And with that, I'll give you a couple examples. For example, there are many languages that are actually disappearing from the face of the earth because people are not able to communicate that information. If, for example, some of the scholars would take their information, record it, place it out on the net, that would at least be there and available for people to learn. You could never do that through just a book kind of communication. Also, if you were trying to, say, teach someone maybe Tai Chi or a martial art, that would be nearly impossible to do from a standpoint of a book. However, if you show them a video, that would be a much more efficient means of communication. So, in my opinion, you know, we have to take the good with the bad on this, and I'd like your comment, please.
Well, actually, what you say about the Internet being the most important invention since Gutenberg is certainly true. And that it is impossible to preserve disappearing languages, it's easier on the Internet, is true. Everything that it is easier to learn Tai Chi from a video on the Internet than from a book is true. But, of course, you can also learn Tai Chi from another person who knows Tai Chi, which I suspect is a lot more effective than watching a video on the Internet. But I'm not here to say that the Internet doesn't open up all kinds of pathways to knowledge that didn't exist before. What I am here to say is that the lowest forms of the use of the Internet are much more common than these higher forms you're talking about. And I'll tell you, here is a good analogy. For the transmission of whole civilizations, there is no better tool than books. Even though everything else you say is certainly true, and I would agree with and not denigrate it, but the transmission of the totality of a civilization requires books. And once we dispense with them and require that we are able to grab information fast rather than spend the time that it takes to learn, we are in real trouble. As far as the use of the Internet for good, I will make an analogy here. In the early days of television, those listeners who are old enough to remember, people thought television had tremendous educational potential in the 1950s. Everybody smart believed in the educational potential of television. And it did have a lot of educational potential. It still does. But the fact is we've used television badly, and I think it's not that there aren't all kinds of good things on TV, just as there aren't all kinds of good things on the Internet. It's that the very nature of passively sitting in front of a screen has tended to make people seek the lowest common denominator. I don't know how you can argue that when you see what kinds of things dominate our television today. What dominates our television today is not anything that, for the most part, that makes people think or gives them artistic experiences. It's a very small slice of the experience. What dominates TV today is mostly junk, and even more now than 10 years ago. The rise of the reality show shows just really how low we have fallen, in which basically people enjoy seeing other people humiliated on TV. So I think that all of these tools, which and you can say the internet is more interactive. Well, television is going to be interactive too. Soon there won't be any difference between television and the internet. And so I don't disagree with all the good things you said about the potential of the internet, but I don't think it begins to be as good a way of learning about civilization as a whole as books do.
May I comment?
Yeah, sure.
that's kind of an interesting perspective. I'm not sure that I entirely agree with that. What I would like to kind of comment on is, in terms of television, the ratings are way down. People tend, especially the younger you go in the population, the less people actually tend to view television. In many cases, they use television as a diversion, and that's why I think the intellectual level of programming has gone down. I personally think the cartoons are not as good today as they used to be when Disney was producing them.
Good old Tom and Jerry.
Tom and Jerry and Curly Moe and Joe had their moments. But some people choose to prefer that or not. But I don't think that the intellectual level is there today. There is some very sharp, pointed commentary, almost cartoonish, that's taking place in there that you may or may not agree with. For example, if you take like South Park, some of that's very biting and has an interesting view into social commentary. So there may be some useful things in there still, but I don't think the relevancy of television is once as great, say, as radio, as once as great as radio, you know, preceded by books. I think the next generation now is the internet, because it really actually provides all of the predecessors in its format. There are now electronic books. Many of these are available on the internet. The bookstores are even selling the e-books that
which
I think
been,
you can go in there.
So far,
and
by the way, have been a total flop.
Well, so far, yeah. I agree with that. But
it's not a matter of dispute. It might be different in the future, but so far there seem to be very few people who actually want to read a book in e-format. We'll see. Maybe Kindle will make a difference. I don't know.
I want to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me, but I'm getting into about my last 15 minutes. I have a number of other callers. And I guess I just also want to make sure that people understand it. As you have said, you're not suggesting that everyone should throw out their television set and we should unplug the internet.
That's not it.
Yes.
I would like to make one just brief comment, because I know there are a lot of other callers. I don't make a distinction between forms of video. In other words, I don't think the reason young people aren't watching TV as much as they used to is that they have many more diversions in the form of video games, in the form of iPods, and in the form of all of the array of entertainment that's available on the internet. I don't make any distinction between the video that appears on YouTube and the video that appears on reality TV shows. I don't make any distinction at all, and I think that's why I say the internet is not some kind of a separate god. A lot of what the internet is doing is transmitting just the same junk that appears on TV screens.
Well, that was my thought, in that yes, one can say maybe young people are watching less television, but they're still spending a lot of time in front of some kind of screen.
Absolutely, because there's so many more forms of screen and take it along iPod entertainment now.
Well, let's talk with somebody else. Let's go to Champagne in line number 2 for our next caller. Hello.
Hi. Two quick points. The first one is, hasn't it always been thus? I'm reminded of Ambrose Bierce's definition of war, which states that war is an activity designed to teach Americans geography. Mm-hmm. And the second one is, I think the reason why so few people read. See, you're assuming that everybody is above average. And you have to realize that half the people have IQs in two digits.
Oh, all right. Just stop right there. I'm assuming that everybody is above average. No, first of all, everybody isn't above average. The majority of people have IQs in two digits. This is the kind of, first, it's absolutely not true. An average IQ actually is 100.
It's 100, okay. But there's an awful big portion of the population that's below 100.
Well, I'll tell you something. First of all, as far as IQ measurements go, as has been so ably pointed out by other people, all IQ does is measure what you've learned to a certain point. If my grandmother, who was every bit as smart as I was, were to take an IQ test today, she would look like she has a low IQ, because there are things that people who graduated from eighth grade in 1913 or people who graduated from college in 1913 didn't know that even the dumbest person knows today. But I'll tell you this, I have been accused of being elitist. I think the most elitist position in the world is to say that the average person, we shouldn't think there's anything wrong if the average person doesn't know anything about geography and history. There is no reason why a high school graduate shouldn't know what our Constitution says. There is no reason why a high school graduate shouldn't know something about the rest of the world. And somebody sent me an email after I wrote a piece for the Washington Post saying just what this person was implying. So he says, first of all, 80% of the people are not going to know anything anyway. And he said, I don't care if my car mechanic knows where Iran is. I only care that he knows how to fix the car. Well, first of all, that is the ultimate elitist position, that somehow your car mechanic is incapable of knowing where Iran is. And secondly, you ought to care if the average person doesn't know where Iran is, because the average person votes. And decisions of life and death, if they are made by people who are not educated at all and who don't know anything at all and who don't respect rationality and evidence at all, affect everybody. And I don't believe that, and I think one of the things that you could maybe call the framers of our Constitution naive, but they believe that free inquiry and learning could raise the level of everyone. And I think this idea that it has ever been thus. In the 18th century, people thought also that women were unsuited to learn to read. And women probably would have done worse on IQ tests. I have no respect for this kind of argument at all. These are the real elitists who think that the average person isn't capable of knowing anything.
We just to get into another point here for a second, and we'll get some other callers. I think that a lot of people would suggest, as the old saw goes, that it's not so much that what people don't know that's the problem; it's what they know that ain't so. You know, and that is something else that you deal with too, and that is not just anti-intellectual, but anti-intellectualism as a problem, but anti-rationalism as a problem. Where do you think that comes from, and the willingness of people apparently to believe very strange things that if you'd think if they thought about it a little bit, or if they sought out some additional information or opinions, they'd realize that whatever that was that they thought was simply not correct?
Well, first of all, there is one element I haven't talked about, which is religious fundamentalism, which I define as people who believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible. Now, understand, I am not talking about religion, but about a particular kind of religion which insists on a literal interpretation of sacred books. You can be religious, for example, and believe in evolution. Only one-third of Americans believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible. Two-thirds don't. If you don't believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible, but you believe the Bible is divinely inspired, you can also accept evolution and modern science. Most religious people in this country regard things like the Bible as a divinely inspired metaphor. They don't actually believe the earth was created in 6 days. But the fact that a third of our people do say that they literally believe the earth was created in 6 days is a problem, because it's unique in the developed world that many people still believe in a literal interpretation of sacred books. And it is, and this will probably make some of your audience mad, but religious fundamentalism is also related to lack of education. The more education people have, the less likely they are to believe that religion requires them to believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible or the Quran. Take any sacred book you want. But religious fundamentalism, it's just too easy to blame anti-rationalism on fundamentalism, because, as I said, fundamentalists are only one-third of our population. The other thing we have to talk about is our school system, which simply doesn't place much emphasis on critical thinking. And, again, the media. And I hate to keep harping on the media, but this is something important. Media also frequently propagate anti-rational beliefs. And one thing that happens is, for example, when you see any story about a controversy on, let's say, television, it always assumes that everybody's opinion is as good as everyone else's. So you will have the opinion, there's a strong, for instance, anti-immunization movement because some parents of autistic children believe their children's autism was caused by immunizations. There, all of the scientific evidence is to the contrary. There have been very careful studies, and the rate of autism is rising at exactly the same rate, both among children who've had immunizations and those who haven't had immunizations. But what the television does when it does this story is it puts a heartbroken parent who, understandably, having suffered this tragedy, is looking for an explanation, and we don't have one yet. And you put the scientist on the other side, and the implication is that the medical study that shows this not to be true is no more to be believed than the opinion of the heartbroken parent. And the fact is the heartbroken parent is a heartbroken parent, but their opinion is not the equal of medical studies of thousands of people.
Well, let's continue. We'll go talk next with someone in Stewardson. This is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would like to make 3 quick comments. First of all, if WILL was not so good, I wouldn't always be listening to the radio and watching TV. For example, tonight, BBC World, they cover things that no other newscast covers. Then, of course, Nightly Business Report, so you can have enough money to afford your TV. And then NewsHour, and then, of course, Gwen Ifill, Bill Moyers. You can't take the Last of the Summer Wine away from me, and Charlie Rose. My second comment was, I thought it was very interesting. Last night on Charlie Rose, he had the ambassador from Singapore who has written a book about the Asian century, and he said that they've made one big discovery, and that is the brain at the bottom is as good as the brain at the top. And the example he used was that in the feudal society, it used to be only the very top people had any use of their, were educated at all. For instance, if you're an untouchable, you'd remain an untouchable all your life, whereas now you could graduate from Stanford. And so it made you look at not billions of people, but billions of brains that are being used. And then my third comment is, I found it interesting. My blood pressure must have been a little low, and I was listening to Rush Limbaugh railing about Barack Hussein Obama yesterday and how that was his freedom of speech that he could rail about his middle name. And we've already elected William Jefferson Clinton, and Jefferson Davis was the president of the Confederacy.
You have a question?
Yeah. Well, I just want your comment.
Yeah, well, and Susan, you can comment on any of that any way that you would like.
What she was doing was praising various TV shows, which is great. I like all of those TV shows, too. It's an interesting question. I mean, this woman is obviously very smart, and what she says, by the way, about the Barack Hussein Obama thing is absolutely true. But I find it hard to understand, for instance, why anybody would want to listen to Rush Limbaugh just to get their blood pressure raised. You know, it's funny. We spend so much time listening to the media, both media we agree with and media we disagree with. I can't imagine a worse waste of time than turning on Rush Limbaugh. Even if you don't know the specifics of what stupid thing he's saying on that day, you know the general tone. Why do people have to listen to the media to get their blood pressure raised? Just walk out on the street. I mean, I really believe that there are better things to do with all of our time than listen to all of these people, even if we disagree with them and are mad at them. You know, why don't we be spending some time taking a walk and thinking instead of listening to any radio commentator, liberal or conservative?
Well, do you think
I'm glad they're listening to your show. But, I mean, you can listen to too much of this, even if it's good.
Yeah. But do you think that as a nation, though, we're really failing to invest in our intellectual capital, and that's something that in the long run is going to be a problem?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think that we have been dissipating our intellectual capital actually for the last 50 years. This is nothing new, and I don't even talk about this in my book because it's too obvious. But what we pay, for instance, elementary and secondary school teachers is shocking. And you are not going to get first-rate teachers when they're paid as little. And also, this is a capitalist society. We show what we value by what we pay to people. And we show, however much we talk about education, we show how much we value good teaching by what we pay teachers. And it's very little. I mean, I think we need to think about that. What are we spending our money on? Nothing shows our values better than what we spend our money on.
We go next to someone in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Well, as one who listens way too much to all of these pundits, I wanted to ask you, there was a diversion at the beginning. How much of it is really a technical argument, and what do you think the root of it is? I mean, America has the credit of having a political party called the Know-Nothings, and they were proud of it. So I'm just wondering what you think is the cause. Is that a good question?
Well, you're talking about the Know-Nothings. Yes, they called themselves the Know-Nothings, and they were proud of it, and they passed into history. I think the problem we've got today is we don't call ourselves Know-Nothings. What we think we know is wrong, or we don't care that we know very little. I would welcome somebody calling themselves the Know-Nothing Party right now, and there would be a lot of people I would put in it. The fact is we have Know-Nothings spread across our culture, and they don't call themselves that.
Well, we have this discourse, the reality-based, or whether you're going to make the reality that you want. That's fairly non-adaptive, it seems. I don't know. I'll thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's take another caller here while we still have time. Line number two, this is Urbana. Hello.
I'd just like to mention two other commentators on the general subject of the morning. One is Jay Leno when he does Jay walking on any college campus. And the other, from a different direction, is the author, I think it was Christopher Toomey, who wrote the book The Republican War on Science. Don't know if you're familiar with
that. Yes, I have. Chris Mooney is his name.
Okay. And it seems like we have a political segment, a large one, not a majority, that is against thoughtful discussion and intellectual criticism just for political gain.
We do. The Republican War on Science, it's also easy to make war on science. What it is that there are various people who simply don't want to accept any science that contradicts what their political or religious beliefs are. So we have, a good example of it is the Bush administration's insistence on earmarking one-third of all money for international AIDS prevention for abstinence-only programs.
And now we have sufficient studies to know that abstinence does not work.
Right, and that condoms do, however imperfectly, discourage the spread of all venereal diseases. But since part of the political ideology of these people is that condoms are bad because they encourage sex, which people are going to have anyway, of course,
yes.
They don't care about the science that shows what an important role condoms can play in discouraging the spread of AIDS and other venereal diseases. That's the sort of the ignoring science for political reasons. Now, I think frankly, I do think in this election we're beginning to see the revenge of the reality-based world. I think that we're having a more realistic discussion. And one of the things that both of the remaining Democratic candidates have said is they want to bring an end to this war on science. And I think that's a good thing. I wish there's a movement. I think the candidates in the general election should have a whole debate only on the issues of education and science. I am told that the television networks are resisting this because they think education and science won't attract a big enough audience. Now, that tells you something, doesn't it?
It sure does. I thank you.
All right. We're down to the point here where we have to finish. I have talked with many people who have written books dealing with social and political issues, and there's a thorough airing out of the problem, and then generally they conclude with their, you know, 5-point or 10-point or 20-point plan to fix the problem. You really seem to end here on a not a particularly optimistic note here, at least leaving this as an open question, whether or not this is going to change or what exactly we can do about it.
Well, I would have been a liar if I'd put a 10-point program for fixing it. But I do think, first of all, you know, all I hoped to do with this book was start a conversation about this. And the response to it shows to me that there are more people who are concerned about this than I might have thought they were before the book was published. And I do think that the first thing, the essential thing we have to do before we can even talk about ways to fix this problem is look into ourselves and the standards we've become satisfied with, and how we spend our own time, and how we apportion the time that young children spend. And so I think that's why I was encouraged to hear Obama talking about, he said, first of all, the education problem won't be solved easily. One thing that's required is better parenting, he said. It was after the Wisconsin primary. We have to turn off the TV set more. Not throw it away, turn it off more. We have to put the video games away more and spend more of our time reading to children and talking to children. I think until there's a raising of awareness that this is a problem and that we're all responsible for it, instead of blaming it on one thing, such as religious fundamentalism or George W. Bush, you might say, you know, my message is that dumbness and unreason, it's us.
Well, there we would leave it with the suggestion that if people would like to read more, they'll look for the book. It's The Age of American Unreason. It's published by Pantheon by our guest, Susan Jacoby. It is her 8th book. You might also look at the one back. That's Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism, published in 2004. She is program director of the Center for Inquiry, New York City, a rationalist think tank. She's also a regular panelist for On Faith, a website sponsored by The Washington Post and Newsweek. She also has her own political blog, The Secularist Corner. That's on the website of The Washington Post. Ms. Jacoby, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Academy for Entrepreneurial Leadership at the University of Illinois, a resource for UIUC faculty and students with entrepreneurial ideas and aspirations. More information available on the web at www.ael.uiuc.edu. Coming up a little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, the search for her great-grandmother's ravioli recipe led food historian Laura Chanone to the homeland of some of her ancestors, Liguria. Eventually, she would discover all the world's a dumpling. Pasta is truly a universal food. Coming up today on the program, Celeste Quinn talks with Laura Chanone. She's a recipient of a James Beard Award and is the author most recently of The Lost Ravioli Recipes of Hoboken, A Search for Food and Family. That's coming up in the Afternoon Magazine in the 1 o'clock hour. In the next hour of this show, we'll be talking about astronomy, and our guest will be Jim Kaler, Professor of Astronomy Emeritus here at the University of Illinois. First, though, we'll break for news and update on the market, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Stuart Peterson. For over 20 years, Stuart Peterson has helped farmers manage both marketing opportunities and risks through their analysis, advice, and action. Stuart Peterson's team of experts and strategic consulting approach utilize the latest technology. Stuart Peterson, confidence like never before. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey. With a look at the commodity markets, where at the Chicago Board of Trade, we're seeing that March corn has traded both sides of unchanged today, while soybeans in the nearbys are showing some strength, a little less so in the deferreds, which have been down today. We did get a piece of fundamental news in the marketplace where we learned that from the Ministry of Agriculture in China that China is planning to increase soybean, peanut, sesame, sunflower, and flax plantings to overcome damage from unseasonable freezing in the spring rapeseed crop, and also, at least in the short term, seek soy on the global market as well. Remember, China is the home of the Olympics coming up later this year. Let's go ahead and look at